Live from the heartland and the crossroads of America, it's Tony Katz today.
The former president has said that he wants to debate the president anytime, anywhere, under any conditions with any moderator. Will the president take him up on that?
I think it's really funny that Donald Trump keeps saying things from Truth Social when he just stays in the basement of Mar-a-Lago. I don't think he's done any campaigning this week while the president's been out there. But look, Major, the president is traveling the country, talking to the voters who will decide this election. We haven't had the conversation about something that may happen in August. But what I can say is the debate plays out every time Joe Biden talks about what he is fighting for and what Donald Trump is fighting for, which is bad, it's rejected, it's toxic, and it's not the American way.
Can I take a moment here? There are two parts to this conversation that I think are worth breaking down. Tony Katz today. What's going on, boo? We doing all right? 833-468-8669. 833-GOT-TONY. That is, it was CBS News, and that it was Kevin Munoz who was answering the question there. He's a Biden spokesperson. It's Major Garrett doing the interview. Two things. First things first, Donald Trump is campaigning from the basement? What exactly are you talking about? Joe Biden campaigned from his basement in 2020. That much is true enough. Now you're going to engage a spin that it's Trump doing it? Literally, as he's talking about this on CBS, they're showing a graphic of Trump doing a rally in Georgia. That is not the basement. It's CBS saying the guy you're hearing from, Kevin Munoz, spokesperson for Joe Biden's campaign, is a liar. It's pretty jarring when you watch the video. It's unbelievable. Here's number two. Why is this a conversation, CBS? Why are you having this conversation? What's the point of it? The odds are that Joe Biden won't even be the nominee. So why is anybody talking about a debate? Also, does anybody think there's going to be a debate? Anyone? I would argue that the vast majority of Americans wouldn't even care. They would be thankful they don't have to hear Trump or Biden go at it. They'd be thankful for a little less crowd noise. Biden's not the nominee. My bet is still there. My bet is still there and looking pretty fantastic. Things could change. But it's easy not to debate Trump. Trump didn't show up for a single debate. It's easy to say he doesn't show up for the Republicans. He wants it from me. Nah, America knows what to do. They know what that guy is. It's an easy thing to do. They can dismiss the debate completely. And they won't even when it's like, oh, he refuses to debate. Oh, he's too chicken to debate. Democrats are just going to shrug their shoulders and go, whatever. Whatever. Now, if it's not Biden, well, then I think they actually have to debate. And I don't think it's going to be Biden. If it's Biden, what is it saying about the Democratic Party? You couldn't find somebody else? You really couldn't find somebody else? That's a story in and of itself. But this is, I share it with you because, A, just the hysterical nature of the political left on that idea of Biden, of Trump in the basement. But this is an example of having to fill time. Debate, not debate, that part doesn't matter. A porous southern border, kids getting killed by fentanyl, and you not being able to afford your mortgage, that's the election. This is Tony Katz today. It doesn't matter how far we get from the first words that COVID was coming, which was, what was it, it's around now that we were talking about COVID and what's going on. It was around now when I got told by my main radio station in Indianapolis, I'd gotten back from CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference, one person had COVID, and they said to me, hey, why don't you stay home for the week? And I haven't stopped broadcasting from home in all of that time from like, what was it, February, March of 2020 till now. And I'm still broadcasting from home. Tony Katz. Tony Katz today. Good to be with you. Phil Kirpin joins me right now, president of the Committee to Unleash Prosperity and the founder of American Commitments, has a fascinating report that is coming out. But I first reached out. It's been a while, Phil, because we talked to you a lot during COVID. You're not a doctor. You don't make a claim about being a doctor, but you do have an uncanny ability to read and understand data. And you were one of the very first people, and certainly the loudest people, discussing that the data doesn't comport with what the CDC and others are saying about how to deal with COVID, about what the numbers really reflect, about conversations about comorbidities, a series of things. But then I saw you retweet something from David Zweig, which says massive drop in cancer diagnoses in 2020. Now, I had noticed in conversations with business owners that if you take a look at all the people who were working from home, you'll notice that that correlated with a massive drop in people calling out sick. Nobody called out sick when they were forced to work from home because it didn't matter. Calling out sick is really wanting a day off. People working from home felt that they had the day off anyway, because if they weren't on their computer or they weren't working or they were watching TV while they were fooling around with their job, it was easy by them. Talk to me about this drop in cancer diagnoses.
Well, you know, one of the really interesting phenomena that was almost completely unreported and still remains almost completely unreported during the pandemic period is that the hospitals were mostly empty. You might have had, if you were in one of the big COVID waves, you might have had more respiratory disease visits than you ordinarily would, but not by a lot. And meanwhile, you got whole cancer wards that are empty. You got whole, they canceled tons of surgical procedures. Some places actually banned by local government ordinance, all kinds of different surgeries and procedures and stuff like that. And so we actually had huge layoffs in the healthcare sector during the lockdowns and sort of the ensuing COVID period, and we had massive underutilization of our healthcare system. We had record low emergency department visits pretty consistently throughout the pandemic period. We had record low inpatient admissions. We had kind of any measure you look at, and people, we've got this report coming out. I think it's going to come out tomorrow for the 4-year anniversary of the 15 days to slow the spread. And you can see we run through a bunch of different metrics on hospital utilization, and it's incredible because we all remember there were all these headlines about hospitals are overflowing and hospitals are full, and then you pull up the data basically for the national data, for the state, even for individual facilities, and they're like record low utilization. And so there was sort of this fear hype that was going on, and people thought the hospitals were full, and so they didn't go, or they were prohibited from going if it was during the lockdowns. And so we had all these headlines about hospitals being full, and there were a lot of wards that were totally empty. And there were a lot of people that were not getting medical care that they actually needed. And so we had heart attacks and strokes that were untreated going up, and that's some of the acute deaths that happened kind of as a consequence of lockdown and panic, as people not getting acute treatment. But then we also had a lot of routine healthcare visits that didn't go on, that didn't take place because of the lockdowns combined with kind of the fear and people hunkering in the basement and that kind of thing. And so the detections of cancer fell through the floor. People were not going, they weren't getting screening, they weren't getting tests, they weren't getting their routine physicals. And so all the ways that we normally detect cancers, that wasn't happening. And that's why that chart that David Zweig posted was not surprising to me, because we'd just done this study and we saw that healthcare utilization collapsed. And so here's this chart showing new papers out, right, that shows that cancer detections were down pretty dramatically.
What
during
I think
that
is interesting,
course,
within this is that we certainly saw that there were people who had health issues who did not go to hospitals for fear that they would get sick with COVID, or because they were told the hospital is full, yet you can't show up, and they did put their health at risk in a series of other ways. But I think the larger question, as you bring it up, was narrative movement as opposed to rational thought. And you have a report coming out that you put together with Dr. Scott Atlas, a medical doctor who's a former advisor to President Trump, and he was a member of the White House Coronavirus Task Force, with Dr. Steve Henke, a PhD economics professor at Johns Hopkins, with Casey Mulligan, PhD, who you work with at the Committee to Unleash Prosperity, that kind of digs into how the narratives moved and how not just perception, you were told something that wasn't actually in your best interest, and how these institutions engaged a fear game. That's my words for it. Instead of a rational game that could have saved lives and we could have gotten through this pandemic a lot easier.
Yeah, you know, I think the most fundamental problem with pandemic response in the United States is that our politicians and our public health authorities thought that their job was to scare us into doing what they thought we should do. So instead of giving us honest information, facts and data, and allowing people to make their own decisions, they came in with lockdown orders and mask mandates and later vaccine mandates, and they tried to scare everyone with panic headlines about the hospitals are overflowing and we're going to have a collapse of our healthcare system. And they thought that in doing this, people would behave more virtuously and they would avoid contact with each other and we would get less disease as a consequence of that. But what actually happened is they totally discredited themselves, and they created panic, and they created all of these second-order problems, which were actually much worse than what they were trying to solve, and much worse than any benefit of what they did. And, you know, we've got a section here. Steve Hanke is the world expert on what actually happened with lockdowns globally based on the actual empirical data. And he found that lockdowns in the United States saved maybe a total of 4,000 lives, total. Which is like within 4, the normal 000? Variation. Which is within the normal variation of what we have, you know, in a flu season. It's just it's totally negligible. And meanwhile, we have over 100,000 non-COVID excess deaths from lockdown and panic per year, which is still ongoing. So 400,000 dead and ongoing from our panic response, from our lockdowns, from all the non-COVID excess that was created. And that's a study that Casey Mulligan contributed to our paper, calculated that number. And then, of course, we also have 50 million people were put out of work. If you use kind of the standard metrics for what an unemployment shock does to life expectancy, then the unemployment shock from the lockdowns, that could cost 1 million lives over the next 15 to 20 years, because people tend to live shorter lives after they have a traumatic unemployment event, disruption to their income, and so forth. The educational disruption is potentially going to shorten millions of lives, because there's a well-established relationship between educational attainment and income and life expectancy.
All right, so, hold on. One second here. Talking to Phil Kirpin. He's the founder of American Commitment and the president of the Committee to Unleash Prosperity. You're making the argument that because of lockdowns, lives were not saved to anything outside of a standard variation, but that the impact on lives is that the lockdowns could cost the lives of 1 million Americans. How do you get to that number, and how many years earlier are you suggesting that death occurs?
Well, those are really good questions. To be clear, you can't completely say that all of the non-COVID excess deaths that we're seeing are from lockdowns per se. I think the fair way to characterize it is lockdown / societal disruption / fear and panic. You were going to have some of that even with a perfect government response, but it could have been dramatically reduced if the government were calming panic as opposed to stoking it. And, of course, we have the example of Sweden, which has some of the lowest all-cause excess in the entire world, that basically took that approach. The deaths we've already seen, the non-COVID excess deaths that we've already seen from lockdown and panic and societal disruption, are about 400,000 people, which is to say about 400,000 people who otherwise would have been alive if we had not had lockdowns and social disruption have died in the last 4 years. And that continues at the same rate of about 100,000 per year, because we continue to see the consequences of that. So that's what we've already seen, based on the calculations that Casey Mulligan did using CDC death certificate data, is about this ongoing rate of about 100,000 lockdown / societal disruption deaths per year, non-COVID excess. What I'm saying going forward is we're going to see a reduction in life expectancy from the unemployment shock of 50 million people being thrown out of work from lockdowns, And there are models that, sort of estimate that over time. So, you know, you're going to have a bunch of people who, because they had this traumatic event of being thrown out of work during lockdowns, now they're maybe going to die, you know, 5 years, 3 years, whatever it is, earlier than they otherwise would have. And there's one study that says over the next 15 to 20 years, people who otherwise would have survived the next 15 to 20 years if they hadn't gone through the trauma of that unemployment shock, that's going to be about a million lives, according to one study that we cite. And then the educational impacts, those are much longer term, but you know, if you have a lot, if you have a bunch of kids that end up being high school dropouts instead of high school graduates because they didn't stick with Zoom school and didn't come back after, well, the difference between in life expectancy between a high school graduate and a high school dropout is about 5 years. And similarly, just if there's learning loss in general across the board, that's going to have an impact in future income and future life expectancy. And so there's some studies that try to quantify that, but it's very significant. The economic and the health impact of the learning losses, which have been enormous.
Now, this study is going to be available where? Where are people going to be able to see it?
It's going to be on committeetounleashprosperity.com. That's kind of the, you know, American Commitment's kind of my main job, but then I also work with Steve Moore and Art Laffer and Steve Forbes on sort of the super group of supply-siders that is Committee to Unleash Prosperity. And so this study is being done under those auspices. And if people get our daily newsletter, hotline newsletter, they I'm sure we'll have a link in there. And if they don't get it, they should. So go to committeetounleashprosperity.com and sign up for the newsletter. But also the study should be posted sometime tomorrow on that site.
Now before I let you go, and I'll make sure I share it as well, these conversations about American lives, these conversations about economic impact, educational impact, certainly educational, economic are things that we have discussed and how kids were affected. I take a look at institutions and how faith in institutions, whether it be the CDC, whether it be the FBI, for other reasons, the DOJ, the institutions have been shattered. And one could discuss the problems there. They could discuss the Marxist desires there, right? We can get down all of those conversations. But I'm curious about the idea of recovery. Recovery and faith in the institutions. Right now, if the CDC recommended name it, I wouldn't take that as a baseline of, oh yeah, I'm going to do that. I'd question it with intensity. Is there anything in your data, in your own research, Phil, that has shown that the CDC, with the vast majority of Americans, can recover its own reputation and be trusted to act as a safeguard for American health?
Boy, they've got to earn it, right? They certainly earned the distrust, and it's going to be very difficult to earn any kind of trust, especially if it's mostly the same personnel down in Atlanta that's posting all this stuff. I mean, yeah, they just posted something, you know, last week or the week before about how we're now in the inter-pandemic period, and, you know, we're going to be ready because the pandemics, you know, we only have pandemics and inter-pandemics, and they still recommend masks and all this kind of stuff. So they have a long way to go. You know, I think that this has got to be a major priority for the next administration, and I hope we'll get a next administration next year, that we don't have to wait 4 more years for that. And I would like to see somebody who actually got the important questions about COVID right take over the CDC, someone like a Jay Bhattacharya, for instance, who would be my pick for it, and then really drill down and clean house of the people who made these errors and do it in a very public and transparent way and replace it with personnel who are going to communicate what we know and what we don't know honestly and allow people to make their own decisions instead of coming out with sort of these heavy-handed, you know, mandates and sort of dictates that try to force people into certain behaviors. And so I think we need to really clean house, and it needs to be transparent, and there needs to be, you know, if there's going to be trust, it has to be earned. And right now it's probably good that they're distrusted because most of what they say is wrong, right? So until they're saying things that actually deserve trust, I think it's fine not to trust them. But I'd like to see that whole place really, really clean house. And what they should focus on, Tony, is just tell us what we know. Don't try to, you know, tell everyone in how we should behave and predict and all this kind of. Just tell us what we know. And I think, you know, I was on your show a lot during the pandemic, and I would say, you know, ignore what they're saying we should do, and look at what's actually happening. This is their own data. This is what it's telling us. And I was always amazed at how often the sort of the policy recommendations and the statements from the head of the agency kind of implied they'd never looked at their own data. They didn't know what they were talking about, because you got the actual data collection and you know, the kind of the data sets and the numbers. They do a good job with that. That was all there the whole time. They just didn't use it. They didn't present it honestly, and I think that's really got to be a focus of fixing the place.
Phil Kirpin, you find his work at American Commitment. It's .org, correct? AmericanCommitment.org?
Yeah, but if you type .com, it'll forward you over, so we got that covered.
Look at who's a fancy man. President of the Committee to Unleash Prosperity. I appreciate you taking the time. More to get to. I'm Tony Katz. Inflation is going nowhere. I should take that back. Inflation is going up. That's the story. That's the details. The interest rate cuts are not coming. Now, I'm not trying to be a guy who's like bad news after bad news after bad news. What I'm trying to do is explain to everyone that what the Biden administration keeps saying, what they keep discussing, what they keep pushing, doesn't comport with reality. That's our fundamental problem. It's like when Janet Yellen, the Treasury Secretary, has the audacity to state that credit card spending, for example, is normal.
How long do you think this credit card debt accumulation can continue?
Well, credit quality remains excellent, and charge-off rates, delinquencies have moved up slightly, but from historically low levels. Most households, even including the lowest income households, saw their overall financial position improve during the pandemic. Their average level of cash balances went up. Their overall finances improved. Now, over time, they've spent some of that buffer of savings, and particularly lower income households are borrowing again on credit cards. I see that as a normalization rather than a disturbing new trend.
Janet Yellen wants you to believe that people borrowing on their credit cards is the standard, is the normal, and therefore everything is fine. Well, it's not fine when the consumer price index goes up, and it's not fine when the producer price index, what it costs to make the goods that we buy, goes up 0.6%, double the expectation. Tony Katz, Tony Katz Today. It's good to be with you. Dr. Matt Will joins us, economist at the University of Indianapolis, as we discuss these things with him often. This is the continued sign, along with the consumer price index, that inflation is up. I have that correct?
Yes. I mean, we saw it the other day. You know, the inflation is not tamed. Double the rate that was expected here and multiply it by 12, which I always do, and you're at 7.2% PPI. 7.2%. We're back to the peaks of the worst situation that we've had in the Biden inflation era. And now you have two indicators in a row. And Tony, you mentioned at the beginning, you talked about reality. All these other things are politics. How can Janet Yellen say that this is normalization? That word is just wrong when you see households starting to default on their debt at record rates for those that are in the prime lending range. That is not good. By that, I mean the ones that are at higher risk. That's the leading indicator of coming turmoil. She knows that. How can she say this when she knows what she's saying is false?
Well, she says it because she's also the same person who told you that inflation was transitory, and then kind of apologized for it because people really didn't understand that transitory could be, you know, 3 years. Well, 3 years of inflation is inflation. That's not transitory. But this increase in the producer price index, this is the cost of goods. This is what it costs to actually build the goods. And this shows a definitive trend back up. Things had been trending down since February of 2023. That was really the case from 4.5 down to 2.5 in November of 23, then at 2.7 in December, 2.7 in January of 24, and now 2.8. That is the change in final demand, less food, energy, and trade from 12 months ago. With food, energy, and trade, it's 1.6, which is still a trend upward. Which number do you pay attention to?
Well, I told you, I pay attention to the current month times 12. That's what I always look at. And that is trending up. Remember, the CPI, which we didn't talk about the other day, was 4 months in a row increasing. 4 months in a row. This is not a downward trend. How can she again say that things are moving in the right direction? 4 months in a row of up is not in the right direction. And the problem here, let's get cut to the chase. The problem is not the Fed. The Fed's done everything they could do. They're out of weapons. They have no ammunition. It's all federal spending, and all Biden wants to do is continue to put billions and billions and trillions of dollars of spending before Congress, and he's causing the problem. He can fix it by just stopping the spending.
Talking to Dr. Matt Will, economist at the University of Indianapolis, and certainly I don't see him putting an end to any spending, but I think the question is, what spending are we referring to when Republicans have control of the House? Not to make it overtly political, Republican versus Democrat, but the idea that there has been intransigence, there has been not much moving in the House of Representatives. So one wonders what spending we're talking about. Is there something new? Are we talking about Inflation Reduction Act spending, infrastructure, quote unquote, resuscitation spending? Which spending do you point to?
What I point to is the non-traditional spending. This Congress is the first Congress in years and years to pass appropriation bills. Everything's been a continuing resolution, and everything's been an emergency special request. This president has not submitted a budget for appropriation. Yes, he has a budget, but he immediately goes in the trash. He hasn't submitted appropriations to the appropriation committees on time as required by law. He also submits these, you know, multi-billion dollar aid packages for foreign countries. Again, everything's a one-off special emergency with this guy. Does he not follow the normal process? Good for Congress for following the rules. They're late, they're slow, but they're passing appropriation bills as required.
So now we get to where this puts us in regards to the rest of the world. And I bring this up because the Biden economic team, Jared Bernstein, President Biden himself, spokesperson Corinne Jean-Pierre, others always want to tell you that we are the envy of the rest of the world. They wish they had our economy. We're doing so much better than they are. Well, our inflation is up. We have Europe in recession. We have China, I would argue, in recession. We have avoided it thus far. How now should we be viewing ourselves in relationship to the globe?
Well, okay, let me say that I agree with Biden. We're not as bad as the rest of the world. So that's your moniker for success, is we're not as bad as the rest of the world. I don't know that we're the envy, though. I mean, look at a country, a city state like Singapore. Singapore has surpluses. This country has one deficit in the last 20 years, and it was during the pandemic. They have surpluses. They run their country like it is a business. Then the citizens are shareholders. That's not the way we're running this. If you want to be the envy of the world, the envy would be Singapore, not the United States.
So now let's bring it back to the United States. We have also heard that soft landing is possible, and soft landing refers to the idea of getting inflation under control, where the Fed has their target rate at 2% without recession. But inflation is going up, which means A, rate cuts are not coming, as we have been saying. But what of recession? Does this make recession more possible?
Yes, the odds of recession just went up. Now, I think a soft landing is still possible. And I know you're going to disagree with me on this, but all they have to do is control inflation or control spending, and they can have the soft landing they've dreamed of. Jerome Powell keeps talking about it. He keeps hinting to it. I'm optimistic that maybe the people in Congress can put appropriation bills in front of the president, and he signs them, and that's the spending that we live with. I don't know if that'll happen, but I'm hopeful that that will be the case. And then we could have the soft landing we've all hoped for.
But again, the spending that's happening is spending that's already been appropriated. It's not like there is this whole new level of spending. You're asking, again, we're getting political. You're asking congressional Democrats to walk into the House where they're not in charge and say, okay, let's reduce some of this money. Let's reduce some of this outflow. That's not coming, sir.
I don't know what's going to happen. I can't predict what Congress, what the Democrats in Congress are going to do. I know what the solution is. I think it's a possibility. You're right that the previously approved spending is what's caused this problem, but we can't think of how to solve it today. It can't be solved today. We have to make the decision today to solve it in the future. And maybe that's 18 months down the road. And I realize in the political world, they don't look down the future.
So as you look at the future, I stated earlier, talking to Dr. Matt Will, economist at the University of Indianapolis, Dr. Matt Will, on the X Twitter there, that rate cuts are not coming. That this idea that, hey, we're going to have three rate cuts in 2024, I thought it was a pipe dream 3 months ago when it was first being discussed. It is absolutely a pipe dream now. Am I right or am I wrong?
I don't know if you're right or wrong, because the Fed looks mostly at the PCE. You know, we looked at the PPI today, the CPI earlier this week, and it's the CPE that they look at. That's the thing that is probably the most accurate indicator of inflation. So I'm going to hold out hope. I'm going to cross my fingers. I'm going to say a prayer that the PCE is heading in the right direction, because that's what the Fed looks at.
But you're not going to place your bet on rate cuts.
I'm not gonna. If I were to wager, I would say we might have one cut this year as a token gesture to the world, but not because the Fed really wants to do it.
So now we get back to the crystal ball, and I get that you cannot, address the future. You don't know the future. Is there something you're looking at, an indicator that you're looking at, that would change how you look at investing, as you indicate how maybe you or the big banks would look at investing strategies, that should give other people a heads up on, oh, they think this is coming, whether it be good or bad?
Okay, now you switch gears from inflation to investing, and I like that. I love the investing world, and I can tell you, yes, the productivity number last month went up. That was a great sign, AI-driven. I will keep looking at the productivity index and see if it continues to improve at a substantial rate. That tells me that Wall Street in the battle against Biden is winning. And I'm hoping that, the Wall Street and Main Street and the economy, the capitalists, can beat Biden and he loses the battle. And I'm going to look at that productivity number, see if they continue to improve their productivity. That's going to be my indicator.
Dr. Matt Will, economist at the University of Indianapolis. I appreciate you taking the time. More to get to. Find everything at TonyKatz.com. This is Tony Katz Today.
There should be maybe a listing of nations like Russia, China, North Korea, and Iran that should not be able to own entities like this.
Well, here's the first thing, and this is the most important fact of all of this, and it needs to be debated, not assumed as a fact. The company is owned 60% by international investors, 20% by the two Chinese software engineers who developed it, the entrepreneurs who began the business, and 20% by their employees, 7,000 of whom are American. So it's a very diverse ownership. It's not owned by the Chinese government. In fact, on TikTok's board, there are no Chinese nationals that control this, that are associated with the government at all. They're CEOs from Singapore. So this is an international corporation, and like every other international corporation, they deserve their day in court. You can't just take their property. Look, I have a lot of arguments with the Chinese communists. I have a lot of Saudi authoritarians, but I'm not saying we should allow banning anybody to do business with the Saudis because they have an unsavory government as well, because they spy on their people.
That is Senator Rand Paul with Brian Kilmeade there on Fox and Friends debating, of course, the TikTok legislation. And Rand Paul's argument is part of a conversation we should have. I have been saying this whole time, I am all ears. Give me a reason why I am opposed to H.R. 7521, which is called the Protecting Americans from Foreign Adversary Controlled Applications Act, which basically says if you are from a foreign adversary, you don't get to have these opportunities to steal from American citizens, steal data, or do damage. we at least agree that the Communist Chinese Party is the enemy and is an adversary of the United States. I think on that, we have unanimity. Tony Katz today. Good to be with you. Find everything at TonyKatz.com. Senator Paul's breakdown here, because I think he's wrong. I like the man. I think he's wrong on this, but I want to hear what it is that he has to say, and that's why I've been sharing it today. You can tell me about this diverse ownership of TikTok, but ByteDance is a Chinese internet technology company, and it's headquartered in Beijing. Incorporated in the Caymans, well, that's to hide the money, but it is what it is. So when he talks about Singapore, these other places, this is data. I don't think he's making it up, mind you. But it hasn't changed the basics here. Meanwhile, the conversation between Brian Kilmeade and Senator Paul did get hot.
I know about the Texas project, and I wish it was effective, but it isn't. We put $1 billion into it, or they did. But they did. He could not assure that ByteDance.
Brian, that's your opinion. That's your opinion.
No, nobody thinks the Texas project did. No, but nobody thinks. Let me finish. Nobody thinks the Texas project is up and running and is effective.
So the thing is when you say nobody believes that it is.
And let me just finish. They could not answer. The CEO would not assure that Beijing would not have access to personal information for 170 million Americans.
And their news feed, I don't think
which
that's
is
true.
Number one with young people, it is true. The number one with young people,
is now. Brian, it's an allegation. You are making allegations against a company owned by Americans, and you have to prove it in court.
Now, this is where I think there's a disagreement. Rand Paul is saying that to ban TikTok or to force divestment is an assault on the Constitution because Americans have ownership and therefore it's an assault on their rights. I think that we should at least accept the fact that he is making an argument. We should take a look at it. I would argue that if that relationship of Americans is connected to Chinese nationals, members of the Communist Chinese Party, then I'm still on the side of a national security conversation. Now, there are many people who say, Tony, this is the start of the slippery slope. Kitten, oh man, you and I are on the same page. I don't know if that means I allow what is happening as is. Now, as I have also argued, isn't this a conversation about parenting? Isn't this a conversation about our own self-control? Why do we allow ourselves to watch this stuff? Now, that's a cultural conversation. That's a much heavier thing to get involved with. But I understand now where Senator Rand Paul's argument lies. I am just not convinced by it. I'm not. But again, ears open. As for what the Senate's going to do, I don't know. Who knows? We'll keep watching. Find everything at TonyKatz.com, TonyKatz.com. Tomorrow, everyone, take care.